Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What pleasure can be found in a solitary search for beauty? Leonard Volk earned his living as an architect for 30 years, but he has fed his soul throughout his adult life through his passion for photography, starting with an extended trip to post-war Europe and continuing into the 21st century United States, holding always to the philosophy that for him, a photograph is a homage to its subject. Volk has now assembled some of his favorite works and a number of his essays on creativity and building a visual vocabulary. The book is called Every Day, and he is here now to talk about it. Leonard, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. Delighted to be here.
You have described yourself as a hunter-gatherer of images. What does that mean?
It just means that I feel akin to my ancestors, the hunter-gatherers, who were searching their world for the significant, and that's what I do in taking pictures.
And it's something that you tend to like to do on your own. Talk about what the kind of thoughts that go through your head and what you're looking for when you go out somewhere with your camera.
Interesting that you say thoughts going through my head, because that's exactly what I avoid. In other words, I have to suppress all the left brain chatter, all the thoughts about the past and the future, and concentrate on my visual surroundings and let my right brain unite with what's around me. And by so doing it, actually it is a euphoric experience.
So you don't stop to ask yourself why you want to take that picture?
No, because I recognize the significant around me through suppression of words.
Hmm. One thing that comes up over and over in the images that are in this book Every Day are things that have a sort of structure to them, even though they weren't built that way. So you'll have light poles and construction cranes forming almost a structure. Do you think that relates to what you have done in your career as an architect?
The whole person is the hunter. Mm-hmm. So my nature as, I am what I am partly because of all the time that I have spent in architecture and in architectural design, and also in photography. After all, I've been photographing ever since January 3rd of 1950, and that's a long time.
Do you know when you come back? In other words, do you have to wait until you have processed an image, or you're looking at it these days, I guess, on a screen, whether it worked, or do you know the moment that you snap the shutter?
It's a process. I don't attempt to evaluate. I simply recognize at the hunting time, and then I only evaluate after I have edited. I mean, sometimes an image may have several significant things in the same frame, but I only find that out after I process it. So it is quite a different experience. It's Yeah, you are two persons. You are the hunter, and then you are the editor. You are the evaluator, and time in between is well spent, because as a hunter, you need to step close to the subject to strengthen the bond between the photographer and the subject, and as an editor, you need time. And you need to step back, because you need distance from the product in order to see it better and not be overcome with the enthusiasm of taking.
So sometimes the experience has been so strong for you that you need a while to know exactly what you have there, or to recognize the best of what you've made?
It's just that the critic needs some separation. Mm-hmm. And of course, your inner critic is your best photographer self, and is you grow that critic through lots of work and through maturity and a lifetime of learning.
The book is called Every Day, and I want to talk about some of the images that you took toward the beginning of the period that you started photographing. And this is 1949, 1950, I guess. You were traveling in Europe. And there are scenes now that are so, they seem very, very distant in time and very evocative. And yet, I would imagine in the moment, that was life on the street. And go ahead.
No, that's...
Well, and I'm wondering if you think we ought to be more aware of the everyday. You know, nobody thinks of taking pictures of things that seem to be very common, and yet later on they become the most precious ones.
Well, my advice there is that that I, as a photographer, and I encourage all other photographers to select, for their personal work at least, subjects that they really care about a lot, because that's the crucial part, is caring about the subject matter. And the surprising thing about photography, which I cannot explain, is how that bond of caring communicates through the prints.
Mm-hmm. So do you think your works, when they are finished, become something different at the moment that you're done with them and someone who was not there while you were making the photograph experiences them?
I can't control the viewers' responses. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they are quite individual, since each one of us is unique and has a unique set of emotions and experiences, but sometimes their responses are similar to mine, and when that occurs, I feel real satisfaction, sometimes joy.
What when you get to a place and somehow have this sense that you want to make photographs, how do you decide what time of day to go there and what you want the light to be like and where you want to stand and the different approaches that you will take to the same series of pictures?
That is something that you have to decide on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like with most things, you take advantage of the moment and your responses are those of that particular moment. But occasionally, particularly with if you're photographing buildings or streetscapes or something of this sort, you may decide that this is an afternoon shot or a late afternoon shot. This is the wrong time. I need to come back again at the right time. However, that is more the exception than the rule.
Now, when you're photographing a streetscape or a building or a nature scene, those things don't blush and become self-conscious and act differently because there's a camera in the vicinity. What changes and how do you have to handle yourself when you want to do a portrait or simply a picture that has people in it?
I really enjoy photographing people, but I don't like to line them up and ask them to smile.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, I think that we all need to do snapshots because that's just part of enjoying life. So I'm not putting that down.
So take pictures of the kids at their birthday, that sort of thing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's good, and we need to do it. But as far as photographing people is concerned, I think I do what most photographers have done, which is to try to get close to the subject without disturbing the people, and wait until they forget you're there. Mm-hmm. And then you're able to photograph them just being themselves, enjoying being themselves. And that is the most fruitful way to photograph people, as far as I'm concerned. This, I have not discovered this. As I say, I think that this is what photographers have done over the years.
Do you know, if you don't think about it in the moment, can you recognize in hindsight, looking at decades and decades of your work, the things that make you want to photograph this person and not that person, if we're talking about strangers?
I can't. This is not a verbal thing. Mm-hmm. This is a matter of the right hemisphere of your brain responding to people and to the moment and to what's going on. So I don't analyze stuff when I'm taking. I am recognizing the significant.
Do your photographs take you back to the moment you were taking the picture, or do they take you back to the moment itself? And does the distinction make sense to you?
Well, that also is kind of complicated, because it depends on the photograph, whether what it means to you and what it means when you're looking at the image may be quite different from what it was when you took the picture. So that's not a simple question.
Mm-hmm. Do you have rules for yourself about how you will edit, whether you will edit? You mentioned that some photographers in the book, you say some people say you should never crop, and you're okay with cropping.
I think that the end print governs. No, I don't make rules. But at the same time, my inner critic likes some things better than others, and I listen to my inner critic.
You have photographs in black and white and also in color. Did you go out thinking this subject really deserves either one, or did you happen to have the camera with you on a particular day and you were working in that format?
Well, this is partly an equipment question, in the sense that when I was traveling in Europe back in 49 and 50, I was using black and white film. So obviously what I produced at that time was all in black and white. And then later on, I took a lot of made a lot of color slides, some of which I developed myself. And particularly I used that when I was doing the macro photos, the small subject slides, back as an architecture student. And now I am taking digitally and editing digitally. And one of the beauties of that whole technology is then being able to choose, so that I may compare the image in black and white with the image in color and decide which way it wants to be, because the subject determines which is right. And it's surprising how often color reduces the impact or the strength of the image, and black and white makes it stronger.
My guest is architect and photographer Leonard Volk. He has a new book of photographs and essays out. It's called Every Day. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with architect and photographer Leonard Volk, who has a new book of photographs and essays out called Every Day. There are links to more information about it on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@KERA.org. Many people, Leonard, have the idea in the modern world that you are either an artist or you are not an artist, and that being an artist is something so rare and so special that most of us can't aspire to that. What do you think about that?
I disagree strongly. I think, let me sum it up in this way. Art, like flying, is freedom. We are all artists if we allow ourselves that freedom. And I think that almost all of us talk ourselves out of being artists at a very young age. My guess about how that happens is that when we go to kindergarten or preschool or something and we make and do lots of things like pushing clay into shapes, or singing, or dancing, or drawing, and we get lots of praise for that from our teachers and from our parents because everything we do that we do seems to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then along come learning about letters and numbers, and we also find out that there are right and wrong answers, and we begin to apply the right and wrong answer to our making and doing. We begin to say to ourselves, oh, I guess the way I drew the horse yesterday must have been right because teacher really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do it the same way again. Well, and then pretty soon we begin to lose confidence and we begin to see how Johnny drew the horse and copy that, and then pretty soon we get bored with it all, and we begin to say, I'm not an artist anyway. I like sports. So it takes an inner drive for someone to insist on remaining an artist and keep on making and doing.
So how do you balance, if you can't entirely eliminate the idea that something is right and something is wrong, because I think it does seem that many artists are very meticulous about what they want to create or making an image or a piece of work fulfill their vision or be technically effective. So where's the balance between, there is no line between artist and non-artist, but there's still a level of quality that you want to achieve.
I think you're talking about the artist's inner critic and the growth of that inner critic. It's not that there is right and wrong. It's that does it meet up with the quality standard that your growth as an artist produces?
Is it interesting for you to go back and look at things that you did 60 years ago and get a sense maybe now, not only of your growth as an artist, but of who you were as a person that wasn't apparent to you then and sort of shows up in the pictures that you made?
Well, actually, I am surprised or gratified to find that some of the things that I took when I was first beginning, I still like.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't explain that, but I have grown and changed, and my critic is somewhat more complicated than it was then, but I still like some early work.
I suppose that has to be encouraging to people who are just beginning to take up photography, because there can be, in the midst of, you know, some trial and error and things that may not work perfectly, there might be these shining examples that lead one to say, all right, I'm going to stick with this.
Well, taking is only half the job. Sharing with others is the other half.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that encouragement that the responses of other viewers are an important part of the experience of the artist. That the artist needs some validation, needs for other people to agree with his inner critic, and that encourages him to keep on.
Do you think that through photography, based on all the countless hours that you have spent with your eye straight up to a lens, that you now always see the world in an enhanced way, even when you are not moving about looking to make a photograph?
Well, I think that it has to make me more alert to what's around me, because what I have learned is that significant subject matter is at my elbow all the time if I am able to recognize it. And this is true for all of us if we are aware and pay attention.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to
Brandon.
Brandon in Fort Worth. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
My question for Mr. Volk is how did he go about getting his book published? Like, is it self-published, or did he go through a publisher?
That was a complicated process. I self-published, but I had two consultants in Santa Fe, one on the concept for the book and the other a book designer, and worked very closely with them. But basically, I self-published, and then my local publisher is Brown Books, and they were not involved in design of the book nor editing the book.
What is it like to go through so many years? Is the editing process essentially the same whether you are just starting out and you're looking at a series of images that you've done, or maybe in a grander sense that you're looking at 50 or 60 years of work and you still want to find the best few in what I imagine are thousands?
Well, this is a job for your inner critic, clearly, but for the whole person, because your feelings are very much involved. So this is not strictly an intellectual matter. This is a whole person response that you're talking about.
You talked earlier about always having the potential to find things that are interesting to photograph if you are looking for them and able to recognize them. Talk a little bit about the series, the macro photographs that you made of things very close up. These are everyday objects. It's paint peeling off something. It's a doorknob. It's a bunch of keys. And yet they are really remarkable when you set them within a particular frame. Can you talk about how you discovered that these kinds of subjects really were compelling to you?
When I was an architecture student in 1958, I got equipment which allowed me to convert my Leica camera into a single lens reflex with a bellows mount for a long lens. And what that did was to enable me to focus on an object. The smallest I could photograph would be an inch by an inch and a half.
Wow.
And use the same rig to be able to focus 11 inches from the film out to infinity. So it was this magical instrument that showed me a new world. All of a sudden, I became aware of how visually interesting and how interesting from a reference standpoint, like by analogy or by metaphor or by just hooking your feelings, these small subjects were, and how strong it was to be able to eliminate everything except the parts that counted most, and to make the most of them. So it was. I also became aware that I was so blind most of the time, and I hadn't noticed all of this fascinating stuff that was as I say, at my elbow. I began to wonder about that. And in fact, the essay which I wrote on seeing that's in the book grew out of my recognition that there are impediments to seeing well, and that seeing well is vital in hunting for pictures.
What does it mean to see well?
It is a right hemisphere unifying with your surroundings, that you identify, you feel strongly about something, and you want to preserve it. I don't.
Well, you talk about seeing actively, which I think is a really interesting notion.
Well, it is a whole person thing, seeing well, and it is also a complicated thing. And I would encourage anyone to read my essay on seeing, because it brings out like there are 8 or 9 major impediments to seeing well, including the fact that we name things, for example, so that in order to, let's say, once you feel that you have identified something, so that you've been able to attach a name to it or at least recognize it and put it in a category, then you don't need to pay any more attention to it, because it is no longer chaos.
Okay,
it
so
is
that
no
mental
longer
shorthand
unidentified.
has filed it
yeah,
away.
Yeah, that's right. So this matter of naming things is just one of the many impediments to seeing well. You have to suppress language, one thing, to hunt well.
As you progressed as a photographer, did the sort of recognition and then elimination of those impediments, were they obvious to you at the moments that they happened? Did you think, oh, how have I not realized this or that?
Well, this was growth over a long period of time, and it's only that when I got concerned about why seeing well was not automatic, and began to analyze it, then I was able to write this stuff down. So this is not stuff that you're thinking about while you're hunting.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that for you the process is not about sort of actively thinking, okay, where can I go to get great pictures, and I want to communicate this. But I am curious, you know, when we think of a photographer at work, whether someone who earns a living this way or someone who simply has a passion for it, we think of a person marching around with a camera very close to his or her face, shooting photographs. And I wonder about the time that comes, particularly before you actually take the first shot, when you're just looking around, when you are allowing yourself to experience visually the world around you, and even allowing your other senses to engage in your environment.
Well, of course, you start out, I hope, in a fertile place where there is interesting stuff going on or interesting things to see. So I guess your first selection would be hunting grounds, and after that you need to not analyze, but to recognize, and then let it happen.
Mm-hmm. Do you started, I guess, shooting digital in 2006? Is that right?
Right.
Do you ever shoot on film anymore?
No.
Do you miss
I'm
the
never
dark
going
room?
Back.
You're never going back.
No, I the macro photos that I made on color slides back in 58 to 61 or 2 had all oxidized with age, and it looked as though you were seeing the scene through a scrim, and all the colors had lost saturation. Well, back in 96 when I retired from both architecture and from volunteering to work on photography, my first task was to try to restore life to these macro photo slides. And the only thing I could think of was not in the dark room, but to try Photoshop and see if I could do it that way. And it worked like a charm. It worked beautifully. And since then, I have never considered going back into the dark room to retrain myself with that kind of work, but have used digital means in order to edit. And since 06, I've been taking digitally as well as editing digitally.
Have you played around with using Photoshop for more than just restoring something to what it once was? Would you enhance an image somehow?
Well, all photography is manipulation. It's like you are recording something unique in time and place in two dimensions when it was taken away from four.
Mm-hmm.
You are changing the grayscale balance or the color balance in the way that you record in the equipment that you use, and you are editing whether you're in the dark room or whether you are doing it digitally. So it's not a question of whether to manipulate or not. The question for me is that you want to protect the faith that your viewer has that this represents a real time and place sometime. You don't want to impair credibility with what you have done.
Architect and photographer Leonard Volk is my guest. We are talking about his new book of photographs and essays called Every Day. You can find a link on the Think page to more information about the book. We'll return to our conversation in about 2 minutes. Feel free to join us.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is architect and photographer Leonard Volk. His new book of photographs and essays is called Every Day. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Leonard, what do you say to people who believe that they can take snapshots at family parties, but that is the extent of their, and I'll put this word in air quotes, their talent for photography?
I think that each person should recognize that he or she is unique. Let's say we all know that this is true because each one of us has a unique set of experiences, but we don't really think about the implications of that. Each one of us has a unique map of the world, a unique set of emotional responses and opinions about the world, which we project on that map of that unique map. And I would encourage that person to find subject matter that he or she cares about strongly and photograph it, because nobody else would choose that same subject and nobody else would photograph it the way he would. And make the most of your uniqueness.
What about the things that everybody has photographed? You know, you go to Paris, you take a picture of the Eiffel Tower. You go to, you know, you go to a garden and you take a picture of a flower. You have some guidelines for people considering making photographs of things that have been documented millions of times before.
Well, I have made a list of over-photographed subjects, as far as I'm concerned, from my inner critic standpoint. And I may take a photograph of something that's on that list also, but if I do, I'm especially aware that it had better be really special, because there are so many similar that have been taken. Now, my suggestion is that each photographer out there should make his own surfeit list, try not to add to the glut of photographic images that are in oversupply. Imagine your viewer saying, "I didn't know I needed that." And if you can't say that about it, maybe you should look further.
There could be something else around the next
That's
block
right.
that is
it's
more
right.
interesting.
Keep looking.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Chris on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. I've been a photographer, I guess, off and on since I was about 10 years old. I'm about 49 now. And I was just wondering if your guest ever considers, when he's photographing something, to how other people will appreciate that photograph, or does he just focus on whatever interests him? Because sometimes I find myself defending what I'm photographing. Somebody will look at what I'm photographing and I say, "Well, why are you taking a picture of that?" And I'm just, "Well, because it interests me. You know, it's either the colors or the contrasting colors or just the shapes or any number of things, you know, that I may see worthy of a photograph that other people just don't see."
Thanks for your call, Chris. What do you think, Leonard?
I'm with you. Photograph the thing that you care about. Listen to your inner critic. And do it. Don't worry about the response of other people. It turns out that if you really care about that thing, that your caring somehow is going to communicate, and other people will tend to respond to it. So keep on.
Is there any need for particularly early beginning photographers to beware of not over-photographing a particular subject, but now that there are no limits, the digital cameras allow us to take 700 pictures of something that takes place in 8 minutes or something. Can we get lost in the noise and maybe not be selective about the way we are capturing an image?
Well, taking lots of images is an asset, but at the same time, it can be a trap in that. But when you're in the editing process, you need to be ruthless about eliminating the stuff that's not up to your standards, and sometimes you won't find out whether something is good enough until you have edited it to see, because some things that look pretty unlikely at first, when you have edited them, turn out to work well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always obvious. But at the same time, you have to be very selective. Having 1,000 images, I mean, you're doing well if you've come out with 50 keepers.
What role does patience play in the work of a photographer?
Determination.
Is it determination?
Determination is what you need. You gotta stick with it and not be discouraged. It's like artists have to be obsessive, because they have to care a lot about very small things. And this is certainly true of photographers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Craig in Dallas. Hello, Craig.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I've shot professionally for, I guess, about 10 years, and then for the last 20 or 30 have been in other businesses, but still shoot consistently. And I was just curious to get your guest's attitude on seeing. It goes back to what he was talking about earlier. It seems to me that a photographer or an artist sees things that other people don't do. And in my experience, I'm curious to compare it to his, is it's more an effort of subtraction, subtracting the extraneous around the object, than it is trying to add something in. And, of course, it depends on the composition. So curious to hear what he has to say about it.
Thanks so much for your call.
I agree strongly with what you say, because it's like the everyday view of the world is panoramic, and it's hard for people to care a whole lot about panoramas unless they're really special.
Mm-hmm.
And limiting what you are focused on, what you have selected as significant around you, is more a matter of subtraction, as you rightly say, I think, than it is getting everything interesting. Getting everything interesting into the same frame is a beginner's compulsion and is not the way to go.
I think one of my favorite pictures in the entire book is some hay bales, and you just see the texture of the hay bales stacked upon each other and then just a band of blue sky at the top. And I just loved it because it's so lush and textural. And yet, if I were walking by somewhere, I don't know that I would have paid very close attention to what you captured so beautifully in that picture.
Well, the reason that I looked at it again was I saw it as a landscape. It was a hayscape because of it was important that the sky be above it, because it was not only the color contrast and the texture contrast between the two, but it was the fact that having that thin band of sky made an analogy to a landscape out of the image.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Logan is on the line now in Rockwall. Hi, Logan.
Hi, nice to be on the show. I had a question for Mr. Volk. I was wondering, how much of the artistic process do you think is in trying to elicit a response from a viewer or a reader, and how much is more to do with kind of a personal vision or something?
Well, I think that it's not a good idea to try to elicit a particular response from viewers. I think it's more a matter of satisfying your inner critic, and then if you have done that well, hoping that other people will agree with your inner critic.
We have an email here from Wes, who wants to know if you find a difference between shooting through the viewfinder with your eye directly to the back of the camera versus holding the camera away from your face and looking at the back panel display. Wes says, I find I don't frame the picture as carefully as I did when shooting through the viewfinder, when everything eclipsed except my focus of what was being photographed.
Well, my bias is the viewfinder is superior to the other alternative, largely because you see the image more strongly, and the framing of it is all important.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Anna is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I had a question for the photographer here. He had mentioned that he was an architecture student back in the day, and I wanted to know, how did that influence you and your photography? Just because I'm an architecture student right now at Texas A&M, and I feel that architecture has really influenced me in the way that I photograph, but I wanted to know, how did that influence you?
Well, the whole visual design aspect of architecture is very much a part of the growth of your inner critic. And architectural design is, that becomes part of the way you see the world. And that's important. And I think that that architects and the way they approach design is let's say photography and architecture are cousins. It's all one design process, and these things go together very well. I think I'm a better photographer because I'm an architect and have an architect's view of the world.
It is interesting that they may be cousins, but one really takes months, even years, for something to go from an idea to being realized. And with a photograph, these days, theoretically, you could take a picture and within 5 minutes have a hard copy of it.
Wonderful.
Nice to have instant gratification.
It's just, oh yeah, it is great to be able to build something which you can believe is worthy, that doesn't take a year and a half to see the sun.
Mm-hmm. No clients telling you, wait, change that. I don't want that. What's in this book? Maybe everything, but talk about some of the key things that are in this book that you have learned over almost a lifetime of being a photographer that you wish you had known a long time ago.
Oh, I think that understanding the hunting process is something that has taken me a long time to realize. That I realized that my method of hunting by engaging, finding a way to get into the right brain and suppress the left brain. It took me a long time to realize how that worked, or that it was working, or what I was doing, and I found that it was my zen of photography, you might say, because I had found a way to do what philosophers let's say this is a Buddhist view of photography, you might say.
So you never lost sight of the fact that you were an artist. You didn't go through that period of self-doubt and then finally come back around to that idea.
I never looked at myself as being an artist at all. I have always just been somebody who recognized significant things and tried to preserve them. So as far as I'm concerned, artist has nothing to do with it. That's a nice word, but this is a matter of joy and being alive.
The new book by photographer and architect Leonard Volk is called Every Day. You can find more information about it on the Think page at kera.org. Leonard, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.